That had to do with resource allocation, because going back to what we said before, what are the risk factors involved here? Brand new, undemonstrated technology, et cetera. And, but we did it. And it's been the basis of very profitable business for Shell Chemical through the years. Had some growing pains, I would say, the first 3-4 months. Our practice, of course, was to bring the people who had invented this whole thing right into the bring-up process. And all. And so, first thing you know, we just knock one problem off after another, and off you go. It's a great, great money maker. Good technology, really good technology, and I guess still exclusive.
Where did the idea originate? Did it originate at Shell Development, or did it, and then they came to you?
Yeah.
Okay. I was wondering if it went the other way around.
Yeah. But they knew that we wanted to exploit the integration of ethylene forward.
Okay.
And we also, at that time, had already had a little detergent operation, come to think of. The group had a detergent operation. That's what called TPOL, T-E-E-T-O-L, based on wax cracking to linear olefins, and then into ethoxylation and whatever for detergents. And they actually had sold, and maybe still are, I don't know, sold detergent at a retail level under that brand. So there was some knowledge of detergents per se at that time. But the idea of going from ethylene forward to that basically showed up.
Okay. You also reached a point, this is 78, where Shell Chemical was contributing a significant portion of total Shell sales.
Yes, indeed. A very big hunk of it, and profit-wise also. We segregated the Shell Oil financial performance, exploration, production operations, oil products, and chemical products. To this day, they are still reported internally, pretty much that way. And in fact, if you pick up their quarterly or annual statements, they will talk about those three segments. Exploration, production, traditionally through the years, was far and away the biggest contributor. Oil products, at times, pretty good. And as I said back earlier, Shell Chemical essentially nothing, or damn little. And as time went on, of course, depending on oil pricing, problems with quotas, entitlements, number of these things, different parts of the company performed at different levels from a profit standpoint. And Chemical became a very integral piece of the performance pie as time went on, and certainly has been carrying its weight. And in more recent times, of course, with the recent upsurge, apparently is outstripping all the others. It's a cyclical business, though, as we know.
Mm-hmm. Whoever has the best crystal ball wins.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was roundly criticized a number of times for expanding olefins too fast from an industry standpoint. In fact, there were people making speeches in that regard and criticizing Shell for plowing ahead on this, that, and the other. But that's okay.
Now, there was a quote from another article wish, again, this was I can't find it right now. I thought it was right here. But you were saying that it takes, was at a point where there was an overproduction of olefins, and you were saying that it takes 5 years, essentially 5 years or more, to build a world-class plant, and by that time the overproduction will be gone, and so you were still going ahead to do that at a time when this is what you were just saying.
Trying to understand the growth rates of materials. This is a materials business, after all, not an energy business. Materials, growth rate of the materials business, whether it's into polymers or any of these other things, that then would call back on the production capacities of the crackers, etc. And that's where the only argument, well, you know, is it going to grow at 1% or 5% or something. And of course, you can get widely different varieties of that.
You mentioned earlier that when Bridges was replaced, the situation changed from.
Yeah, it did. He was replaced by a man named Bookout, John Bookout. Petroleum engineer, and had great success and well deserved, I might add, in his exploration and production, stepwise promotion, etc. Became Shell Canada's president, as had Bridges before, and then when Bridges retired, he came here into Shell Oil. Bookout was a man basically, this is going to sound severe, I'm afraid, that doesn't trust anybody. And so, remembering now what my thesis had been built on, organization and the whole thing, it just didn't really click. Didn't mean that we were at each other's throats, far from it. Didn't mean that he was going to redo or revert things that had already been done organizationally. None of that. In fact, he didn't do any of that the entire time that I had left. But it did mean a real struggle for resources. Again, that's where the battle was. And he could not be convinced, as an example, that such and such kind of a project should go forward. A couple of classic examples of that if we had done them, you know, we'd be dominating the industry at this stage. I can see that. I'm not sure he even remembers it, but that's beside the point. But the relationship was cordial on a personal basis. It was not close. And from time to time, this struggle for resources would take on a form that I had great difficulty living with. And the form would be wherein he would have his corporate economics people redo the economics that my side of the house had done. I mean, redo them, whether they matched or not, and then pull them out with a chart, unannounced, and this sort of thing. And that happened. And of course, if you're gonna have some trust and faith in you, oh man, you don't do this kind of thing. Right? So it was not good from that standpoint. He a very bright, a very capable man, a very good leader in his own way, But he did not build, even in his exploration production side, he did not build a camaraderie or a team anywhere along the line. He probably would profoundly resent me ever saying that, but it was so true. I mean, you could see it all the time. And in fact, people left at a senior level because they just couldn't stand some of this. So those years were certainly different than the years before with Bridges, and but they were tolerable. The toughest period of my entire career was the last 6 or 8 months before retirement, because in direct contrariness to what I had recommended and said that they should not do, he appointed my successor a full 9 months ahead. And so for the last 6 to 8 months, this guy, who was a great guy, and in fact he'd been one of my guys, was sitting in an office next to mine. And of course, you know what happens then. Well, people were talking to Jim. And that, you know, it was all right. I could see the, you know, you could see there's an end to the tunnel here. And so it wasn't all that hard to live with, but it was certainly the wrong way to do it. And it was not really productive from the standpoint of the organization. Lots of worms moving around by that time.
So you had already announced that you were going to retire?
Well, that was required by age.
Oh, you were...
Age 60.
60.
Oh. Age 60. Senior levels.
Okay.
And from that general manager level up in Shell, 60 is mandatory retirement.
Okay.
And so everybody knew, and they knew damn good well, that I wasn't going to be extended with Bookout sitting there. They knew that. So, and in fact, very, very rarely has anyone ever gotten extended. There was no real reason for it, anyway. So they knew, and I knew, and so that was it.
I didn't realize it was age 60. Is that is that unusual?
It's unusual in the industry, and not only the oil and gas, but in all industries. But it's been there forever.
Oh, really?
Royal Dutch Group.
Okay.
It's not a new policy. It's been there forever. And the theory is that you bring on the new and brighter ones faster and with more vigor in your management. And overall, I think that's right.
Mm-hmm.
There are exceptions, of course. There are people at 65 or 70 who can outdo a certain 45-year-old. But by and large, on the average, it's good. And it's kept the outfit, you know, really rolling.
The Dow has this deceleration policy, which I don't know. I've talked to a number of people who have gone through it, and they get very mixed reactions to it.
I have some good friends in Dow through the years, I have mixed feelings about the quality of Dow's.
You know Ben Branch? You know Ben Branch?
Yes, I knew Ben.
Yeah, I interviewed him not far from here, I don't think.
He's over here somewhere,
right near the... It's not far from the Galleria.
No,
the Summit, I think. A number of years ago now. But
yeah, I knew Ben. And Gerstacker.
Yeah.
Arifus.
Yeah, I've interviewed all of them on the Dow project. It was very interesting.
Yeah.
Let me at this point come to some remarks you made in your address to the Society of Chemical Industry when you received the award in 1978, I believe. And you titled it The Vacuum of Leadership, which is a very unusual title. I was wondering how you came up with that.
Because we didn't have it in the industry.
Okay. You talked about mass psychology heavily influenced by individual political whims.
Right.
Well, and this was just coming out of the energy crisis, wasn't it?
Yeah.
At that time.
Yeah.
And I was intrigued by...
Well, a lot of it also was aimed at the environmental side of things, too. Because the industry was, well, it was behind the times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you made that... we talked earlier about the comment you made about being a good citizen.
Yeah.
it was intrigued by the fact that while you start out saying you're a positive person, and that's been very obvious this afternoon, you then went on to describe a number of negative kinds of situations that existed at that particular time. I was very intrigued by this statement: the more we turn to Washington, the more we can expect Washington to control our business.
Well, I think that's right. I still would say that. I guess I began to realize that when I had the Brookings exposure. The level of competence at any particular administration, let's put that, any particular time frame in Washington is highly suspect. There are times when the top structure is really first class, and I mean first class in terms of intellectual capacity, the desire to do the right kinds of things, in their view, you know, whether you agree with that particular thing or not, honesty, integrity, etc. And there are times when that's not the case. And there are also a sign from the top layer who fit either one of these categories at any particular time, you know, competent or not.
Mm-hmm.
Below that, there is a mishmash of non-performers and hangers-on who draw their paycheck and basically are parasites. And I can see that. And you could also see then the functioning when you got to the energy crisis and the various regulations that went in with entitlements and this thing. You could see not the top people, whether they were good or not, involved in those and the making of those and the interfacing with the industry, but you could see the incompetence, the hacks, if you will, in the government doing that kind of thing. That today is still the case in places like the EPA, as an example.
Mm-hmm.
I can't speak from personal experience nowadays, but you can see it in the press.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what that sort of statement is. I did not then, and I have not since, had any confidence at all that turning to Washington is going to solve the industry's problems, whatever they may be. And not going to solve it in terms of crude oil availability or labor or, you know, maybe.
You talked then about the increasing self-centeredness in business, government, and academia, but especially in the chemical industry.
Well, let's see.
You're talking about fractionation amongst the industry itself.
That's, you know, there were... Let me go back a little ways. This involves the CMA. And of course, I served as a chairman of the exec committee on stage. I'll tell you a little story about how that came about. I had been on the board simply because, and incidentally, my predecessors in Shell Chemical never were. McCurdy was for 1 year at one time. But we went through a period of time where they got acquainted with me on the board situation. And then, you know, then it came along the consideration of the next leadership of the association, etc. And one of your Dow friends came to me and said, "We would like for you to be chairman of the executive committee." I said, "Fine." "Even though you are from an oil company," he says, "we think you're okay." Now this, I cite this as an example of the fractionation. Mm-hmm. There are, well, there were at that time, you know, a half a dozen biggies, pure chemical, who, despite any legitimate or reasonable interface with others, simply were not going to do it. You know, they were going to control the CMA. They were going to dominate any discussions with the EPA, or, and certainly the big, big arguments that have been going on long before this speech about allocations of hydrocarbons to the chemical industry from the oil industry. I'm sure you remember some of that. And those were bitter, and they were and they obviously didn't help either side. It didn't help the industry. It just was a diversion. And again, it involved a lack of trust. They just simply couldn't believe that an oil company would look at it this way and this way, and that's out of that they'd get their fair share. So that's fractionation. Now, what was my statement again?
Increasing self-centeredness amongst business, government, and academia, including chemical industry. That's just a paraphrase of the.
Yeah.
We see an increasing self-centeredness, not only among states and regions, but also among business and government and other institutions within business and industry, including the chemical industry. Right down to the individual.
Yeah. Well, it all goes to those particular viewpoints that we've just been talking about. Certainly, the EPA, as an example, has used that as a government piece of government thing. So self-centered that as to view good science as being prejudiced. Because it came from something over here. Now, maybe self-centered is the wrong, not quite the right word here, but an ability to look at themselves as know-it-alls. And I think some of that's still going on. So, I don't know so much about academia. That's changed so much since then. I really don't know why I dumped that in there.
Well, the late 70s, the academic institutions were still a hotbed of
The anti-war.
Anti-war efforts. And
anti-nuke, anti-war. Right. Probably that. Not this political correctness thing that's going on now, which really runs me up the pole, I'm afraid.
One other thing that I picked out of this, which will lead me to that sheet that you have, we've covered most of that, but there are a couple things that I did want to touch on specifically, and this last part leads to that. And you said there's plenty of room in today's modern technological and internet informational businesses for creative and innovative thinking. And yet you related that as to better ways to get some of these things done that you were talking about. But
yeah.
This brings us to this whole concept of innovation in chemistry and what it means and how do you encourage it?
Yeah. Well, I think, again, I think I would largely exclude the government as being a stimulus to this. Not because they don't have the power at times, and certainly under some circumstances, the dollars to do some of it, but I'm not sure they have the capability of judging what things need support and what are not. Now, the national academies, I hope, are listened to from time to time. I'm not, you know, they come up with the recommendation, and it seems to me about three quarters of the time it just kind of disappears and we never hear anything more of it. So I really, from that side, I don't see that as really the stimulus, but I do think that a forward-looking industrial concern needs to make sure that it has a research and development budget that is what in my view would be called substantial. And that doesn't mean necessarily a DuPont level of research or what have you. But again, with the concept of being able to attract and keep technical talent coming out of the universities on a steady basis into a steady and demonstrated research environment, technical and research environment, people can feel that they do have an opportunity.